Welcome to the New York Times podcast, your I do not even know how to get to shakedown street of music news and criticism. I'm your host, John Caramonica. As Taylor Swift once famously said, where were you on the night of July 16th? Maybe where you were was at the final show of the Dead. Longtime listeners of podcasts will well understand that this is perhaps a blind spot for me. The popularity of the longstanding fervor around the Dead and the Grateful Dead and all the spinoff bands, Further, etc. But you know what? It's time for me to grow up. It's time for me to step into my adulthood and learn something. And so given that the Dead has completed their final tour, not necessarily the final performance, but final tour with its current lineup, I thought this is a perfect moment to reflect and get someone in here who can help guide me through what's been going on, especially on this last tour, but also the last few years. To talk about this Space Jam subject matter this week, two segments, two guests. First, Scott Bernstein is going to be here. Scott's the editorial director of Jambase, a fervent chronicler of this universe for years and years and years. He's going to talk about some of the big picture issues at play in the Dead and the Dead & Co. and all of the many, many tributary offshoots from that universe. And then later, Mark Tracy is going to show up. Mark wrote about the final Dead & Co. shows, final in quote marks, Dead & Co. shows for The Times. And we're going to talk to Mark about the relationship between Dead and Fish and also the appeal of the universe of the Dead across generational lines. But first, Scott Bernstein is here. Scott's been going to these shows based on his writing for a long ass time. First of all, welcome to Popcast.
Thank you for having me, John. Glad to be here.
I'm psyched you're here. Also, you are currently, by the time this airs, this will have happened already, but you are in Boston for Jambase's 25th anniversary, right? What's the vibe? What's going on for these events?
That's correct. We're really excited to celebrate 25 years of our site, which is the destination for live music. We have articles about all that's going on in live music and listings of concerts all around the country and internationally. And so this weekend, we're celebrating 25 years. We've got BTALC Big Band, which is a jazz meets big band ensemble, which is playing in Somerville at Sally O'Brien's. And then we move to Boston Harbor Distillery, where we've got Club to Elf, a incredible Boston-based band. Also on the bit of the jazz, improvisational tip, and Jennifer Hartswick and Nick Casarino opening for them on Friday. Before we move down the South Shore to Soundcheck Studios for two nights. First, we have the Jennifer Hartswick band. Jen is a member of the Trey Anastasio band. Trey is the guitarist and leader of Fish, and she's been in this band for over 20 years. We also play on Sunday. We've got Humphreys McGee, a huge band in the improvisational jam scene that's got a sold out show. So we're really excited for all of it, and also have a great pianist, Holly Bowling, who will be opening the action on Saturday.
At the beginning of the episode, we were listening to Althea from the final Dead show, which was on July 16th. We'll get into some of the specifics of that show and that band in a minute, but I think I want to open with a little bit more of a philosophical question, especially given you just named a litany of artists, multiple generations playing this festival that you guys are throwing, or this set of shows for your celebration. Can you trace them all to a common antecedent? And is that antecedent, is it the original Grateful Dead? Is it Fish? Like, where's the kind of, if you're family treeing everything back, where is the point where all of those family trees hit the same root?
I think it's the Grateful Dead improvised in concert while playing rock music. And that's really, they were one of the first huge bands to do that. So a lot of the Humphreys McGees, the Holly Bowlings come from that. And Fish and Grateful Dead have been compared since the beginning of Fish. And it's only in that they play different songs each night and they improvise live. Their music is so different from each other that it was unfair that Phish had a deal with the Dead Caparison for so long. And Phish did everything they could until they became big enough that they didn't have to worry about the Grateful Dead Caparison. But I do think that a number of the bands that are playing this event this weekend do trace back to the Grateful Dead and more directly Phish, because they're of the generation after Phish.
This may be, again, forgive that you're going to get a lot of dumb questions from me today, so forgive me, but hopefully they'll lead to productive conversation. In the same way that these bands trace back to the original Grateful Dead and a particular approach to playing music and also the style of music played in that particular way, the relationship between the Grateful Dead and the Dead currently, can you talk a little bit about the ways in which the most recent iteration of the Dead, quote, both was reverent to but also innovated past what was happening with the original band?
It's important to know that when Jerry Garcia passed away on August 9th, 1995, the members of the Grateful Dead decided to retire the name the Grateful Dead. And they did move forward afterwards in various configurations, originally using the name The Other Ones, and then moved on to The Dead and leaving the Grateful part behind. And then in 2015, it was the 50th anniversary of the first Grateful Dead show. And at that point, the four core members of the band who were surviving, Bob Weir, Mickey Hart, Bill Kreutzmann, and Phil Lesh, got together and played a series of shows at stadiums in the Bay Area and in Chicago under the name Fare Thee Well, celebrating 50 years of Grateful Dead. And for those shows, which were huge in our scene and all sold out tickets through the roof, the four members, core members of the Grateful Dead, made it clear it would be the last time they would be performing together. That was for the four of them. Three of the members, everyone but bassist Phil Lesh, went on and formed a band with John Mayer and a couple of other guys called Dead & Company that started in October of 2015. And that is the band that has carried the flag, played arenas and stadiums for the past 8 years before embarking on the final tour this summer and ending on July 16th, AT&T Park in San Francisco.
As a musical proposition, do you feel that people have gravitated towards this version of the band, the Dead & Co. version of the band, to scratch an old itch, or is it something fundamentally new?
I think it's a mix. I've been very surprised to see how many young people have been attending these Dead & Company shows. And I think certainly they appreciate the lineage and the vibe and scene. You joked about Shakedown Street, and Shakedown Street is the name of a Grateful Dead song that was the title track of their 1978 studio album. And it became the name of the parking lot scene at Grateful Dead shows, where community and sales of all different types of things. So I think for the young people, a lot of that is wanting to experience Shakedown Street as well as the music. And as far as the music, I think it's carried forward where the Dead were at in 1995, with obviously John Mayer adding a new twist to it. But they're playing pretty much the same repertoire that they did in 1995, along with some older stuff that got lost along the way of the Dead's 30-year career, the Grateful Dead's 30-year career.
Can you talk me through what you felt this tour achieved musically? Obviously, it achieves a lot historically, you know, and spiritually and also financially. Very good at business, these folks. Very, very good at business. But can you talk a little bit about what this tour achieved musically?
There was a big change for this final tour, and that was that Grateful Dead original co-founding drummer Bill Kreutzmann stepped away from the band pretty shortly before they started the tour. And in its place, they brought in Jay Lane, who had played with Primus and was also a member of Bob Weir's various side bands for over 20 years. And he brought a new energy and vitality to the music that I really feel like they hit a new stride this summer in a big way. One of the big criticisms of Dead & Company was the tempo. Slow & Company was a phrase that was bandied about.
Damn, sick yes. Bird. Sick bird.
Yes. And that went away. Jay brought a good energy to it, and they went to new places. They mashed up this song Dark Star and A Big River by Johnny Cash in a way they never had before. It's sad that it ended because they really, after 8 years, hit their stride in such a big way this past summer.
So let's listen to a little bit of that. This is Fenway Park, June 24th. Dark Star, Dead & Co. As a sort of casual, distant observer of this ecosystem for a long time, and also one who professionally writes about bands who say they break up and then they reconstitute, they go away for 6 months, they refeel. There's no such thing as retirement. I have a built-in inherent skepticism about bands that say that they are breaking up, that they're never going to perform again. I've been at enough farewell shows of artists who say this is the last one and then some period of time later come back. Within this world, is there, how can I say, internalized skepticism, head scratching about the truth of the retirement or the truth of the end of this era? Is it more of an understanding that everything mutates and changes and there will continue to be music made by these folks, just potentially in a different configuration? How is that thought of internally?
I think in both of those things, yes, the music will continue by the members of the band in various formations. Bob Weir has a band, Bob Weir and Wolf Bros, that they have been playing for 4 or 5 years and already have a tour planned for this fall. So he's definitely a road dog and going to continue to make music. Also, after, certainly there was skepticism when it was announced as the final tour, but as it went on, and as there were so many magical moments over this past summer, it was clear that the band members themselves were starting to reconsider the move to have it be the last tour. Mickey Hart gave an interview where he said, it's going to be the last tour, but it doesn't mean we won't play together. And we never said we'd stop playing together. John Mayer, the day after the tour, put an Instagram post talking about how magical the summer was and saying that this band will play together again. What the future holds is not clear at this point, but there will be a future for this band. And I think coming into the summer, they were more sure of it being the final tour than they are right now.
Can you talk me through, again, forgive me, as a novice, what do you feel each individual member of the band is excelling at in this most recent iteration? What's the thing, if you were to point me and say, John, this is actually where I need you to focus on this. What are the things with the individuals that you think would really speak to someone who is coming to it relatively cold?
Bob Weir is the voice of Dead & Company when it comes to representing the original members of the Grateful Dead. And he is a rhythm guitar player with a style all his own and such a unique and inventive style. And what's interesting with Dead & Company and since Jerry's death is he started singing a lot of songs that were written by Jerry, that Jerry sang throughout the whole Grateful Dead career. But Bobby really leaned into it. And as the years have gone on, his voice has become stronger and he's really brought a nice tone to these songs that really works well, especially ballads. So I think that's where he really stands out. And then as far as John Mayer, he has really impressed as someone who didn't come from this world, who was more of a blues guy and a pop guy. He has the Jerry licks down while still infusing it with his own style. He isn't a Jerry clone. And he's also got a great voice and sings probably, I'd say, a quarter of the songs. The drummers, the Rhythm Devils, Bill Kreutzmann and Mickey Hart, they not only propelled the songs, and of course, Bill left before the final tour, but a major part of the show was called Drum Space. And that was when the stage was just turned over to the Rhythm Devils. And they have this huge setup that they really kept it interesting. Added elements of even EDM and samples to the mix. And then the instrumentalists would come on stage and would purely improvise, not based around the song at all, for the drummers would come back and the rest of the show would continue. Bassist Oteil Burbridge came to Dead & Company from the Allman Brothers Band. He was the Allman Brothers bassist for over 15 years. And he got the Dead & Company gig about a year after the Allmans broke up. And not only has a bass style all his own, and brings a groove, such a cool groove to these songs. He also sings occasionally and focuses on Jerry Garcia ballads with a beautiful, soulful voice. As I mentioned, Jay Lane came from the Primus world, but also was Bob's guy and added a vitality and strength and energy to these songs. And finally, there's the keyboardist, Jeff Cometti, who is the secret sauce to this band. He plays so many different instruments, whether it's a clavinet, a synthesizer, electric piano, acoustic piano, adding different tones and elements and colors to this music, and knows it so well. And one of the coolest parts of the Dead & Company experience for me was watching the chemistry he had with John Mayer. The two of them played off each other so well. And that's what I'm particularly going to miss about this band if they don't play together again.
I'm interested even just hearing you talk through everybody's, especially the newcomers, relatively speaking, into the universe, about the durability of the music, in that you can bring in someone like Mayer or Oteil Burbridge, who come from different lineages. And on some level, they're there to be faithful to the source material, but they come with a different toolkit. And I wonder, when those new toolkits are applied, and the music, it has a new energy, it has a different texture to it. How is that generally received within the community? Is there a transition period of adoption of, we're not sure if this makes sense, and then over time, people get acclimated to it? How does that work? Both, and I think those are probably two instructive cases. One, with Oteil Burbridge coming from the Allmans, which is a very different kind of band, but also with John Mayer coming from more of a pop sensibility and also, frankly, being just a very well-known famous person who is like sublimating himself to the cause of the music. How have those transition points been for both of them in terms of fan reception?
I think there was a lot of skepticism when the band was formed, with John coming from such a different world. And to be honest, I think there is still a number, there's a percentage of Grateful Dead fans that have never bought into Dead & Company, but there's a large number that did, and it took them time, And the band took time to warm up. They certainly didn't start from the a heady level, but worked up to it. John Mayer certainly put in the time. He learned a huge repertoire of songs and had them down. I mean, it was never warming up, needing time for him to warm up. But I think it took, there were some fans that no matter what any member of the Grateful Dead is going to do, will be there, are just the love the music so much that they, it doesn't matter what it sounds like. I hate to say it, but they'll be there no matter what. So there were certainly some of those people that were there for Dead and Company. But I think they also impressed a number of the skeptics over time. And the proof is in the pudding. They played stadiums. They sold out stadiums. The numbers of concert gross that they did was pretty mind-blowing. And up there with the end of the Grateful Dead.
Sometimes over the last 10 or 15 years, I found myself at shows of artists who don't have loads in common musically with the Grateful Dead or any of the spinoff bands, but there was something about the relationship of the crowd to the artist that to me felt like what I imagined the relationship of the crowd to artist in the Dead universe was like. I think there are some people who feel this way, frankly, about the Dave Matthews Band. Certainly there are people who feel that way about Phish. I remember having a very vivid sensation of that at a kind of one-off Bon Iver show where I was like, he's going to be doing a version of this for 10 or 20 or 30 years. He's never going to have a pop hit in any sense, but he is going to cultivate this faithful who like are experiencing themselves through what it's like to be in that shared space with him and whatever experimental or improvised thing that he's doing on stage when he's improvising or when the band is. I wonder if you can tell me a little bit about the expanded ecosystem of artists who you think are taking little pieces of the Grateful Dead's approach to developing community, because to me that seems as valuable as the music itself. You can have incredible music, but if you can't convince people to come back and come back, that's it. You're a niche, you're a novelty. Tell me a little bit about the community building and how you see that's playing out elsewhere in music.
What's really been fascinating to me is how it's always been a thing for jam acts or rock improvisers to play different music every night and have audiences that are willing to take chances with them, that want to see them expand the song and hit new territories. But it's really come into other worlds, into indie worlds, into even Metallica. Metallica now doesn't play the same set list every night and has built a community of fans that are really interested to see how their shows are going to be different from night to night. Even Taylor Swift in her latest tour has the surprise songs elements, switches it up a little bit. And I think that's all grown from the Grateful Dead's playing different songs every night, never playing the same show two nights in a row, and having an audience that is excited for that, that wants to be in a community that travels from show to show and sees a band that plays different things from night to night and keeps the set list and their song chasers. I mean, even I'm sure the Taylor Swift world, there are people that are still looking for a song that she hasn't played yet that will be in one of these surprise song segments. And it's really expanded well beyond just being in the jam world and the rock improvisation world to the indie world where lots of other bands, and again, Metallica and Taylor Swift not playing the same show from night to night.
I think of the Grateful Dead and that full ecosystem. I'm thinking people traveling, seeing a lot of shows. Obviously, that happens with a lot of acts. There's a lot of merch to buy. Has it on some level become a little bit of like a luxury proposition to be a committed follower of this world because of the amount of travel or other funds that have to be spent. Obviously, we're not in the 60s, we're not in the 70s anymore. Things are costly. Like you said, the gross of these tours is huge and the tickets are incredibly expensive, not out of step with what I assume Taylor or Drake or whoever all else charges. But on some level, have the economics of it changed in a way that has also then subsequently changed who's showing up or who can show up?
Definitely. It's harder to make it from show to show with tickets being $100 rather than $40. I mean, especially that's true of Phish. In 1994, tickets were $20. Now they're $100. And I don't think that's inflation. I think that if today's dollars, $20 is probably $60, is the price. Concert tickets have become much more expensive. And at least with the Dead & Company world, there's more of the community that's formed around it and the selling wear, selling food, selling t-shirts, selling different things to help make it to the next show. And I think that's a big part of it. But it's definitely harder than it was in the 90s and certainly in the 80s and 70s. So there probably are less people that go, that do a whole tour or go from night to night.
And again, forgive the naivety of this question, but that thing that you just said of selling something, whether it's shirts or food or whatnot, to daisy chain to get to the next show, that's still happening. You think there are still people who are like, I'm trying to earn $500 in order to get the ticket for the next show and the gasoline to get there and to pay for the hotel or whatever that night. People are still doing that almost like hand. There's some segment of the audience.
100%. When I went to Shakedown Street at the last Dead & Company show I went to, there were just aisles and aisles of people selling wares of all different sorts. So there's lots of people that did that. And I'd also say there's also a lot of Grateful Dead fans that are in the higher income bracket of they are older and we are everywhere is a phrase that's used about Grateful Dead fans. And there are fans in all different income brackets and a lot of rich Grateful Dead fans. So those people certainly could pay the money. And Dead & Company would do these destination events every year in Mexico, playing in the sand, they called them, where they play at an all-inclusive resort. And I think that was less the people going, living show to show, and more the to-do Grateful Dead fans that were affording those thousands and thousands of dollar packages.
And is there any internal anxiety within the scene itself about the Dead should be for everybody, but some part of it is for people who can afford it?
There's not too much. I think it's just become accepted that is part of life. And you could see the various other projects for cheaper than you could Dead & Company. And certainly Dead & Company tickets seem to be more expensive when they did the final tour than it was in previous years. But I didn't hear much complaining about ticket prices. I think it's become a fact of life and accepted within the community.
Speaking more broadly, before we go, like working at a place like Jambase, also I saw that you also write a lot about Phish in a separate blog. Can you just tell me a little bit about the broader system space of improvised music and how it's changed in the last few years? Because one thing I feel like I notice casually is, especially in what I would think of as like indie rock spaces, people seem to be tilting a little bit more in that direction. That seems to be a little bit more prevalent among younger bands. And I wonder if you could talk me through how you've seen this philosophy grow, mutate, and where is it right now? How big is the universe and how rangy is it?
We're called Jambase, and certainly at the beginning, we had a focus purely on jam bands, but now it's just about music, and we're about live music and bands that do anything that's different, that's special from night to night. And it's the world of indie and jam has really, the barriers have completely gone away over the past 10 years. There's bands like Goose, one of the top up and coming acts that improvises and plays different shows from night to night. But those guys were just as influenced by Bon Iver as they were by Phish. And obviously that comes through in their music. And I think everyone wants special live music experiences that are different. They're less impressed by the acts that play the same show night in and night out. So our audience has certainly widened in terms of who comes to Jam Bass, who we cover has widened, and what the bands do that we cover has widened. And it's been a beautiful thing to see. I certainly like all sorts of different types of music and never want to be pigeonholed to just one genre.
No, I'm glad you mentioned Goose, because that was a band that was very much on my mind as I was thinking about this space. Scott, before we go, if you were to say to me, John, you've got three hours of your life, 4 hours of your life, and you should listen to this one recording, this, whether it's Dead & Co., any of these other, there's one thing that's really going to encapsulate everything that is special about this world and coming from it relatively cold. Drop me some homework and then we'll listen to a little bit of something as we go, but drop me some homework.
I'm going to go with the Grateful Dead played a special concert in 1975 at the Great American Music Hall in their home city of San Francisco. It was released on a recording called One from the Vault, which was really one of the first live archival releases ever put out. And it starts with Bill Graham introducing the band, and they play the Holy Triumvirate of Help on the Way, It's Slipknot, It's a Franklin's Tower. Such a powerful, masterful version of it. I think anyone who loves music would love this sequence of songs. And it also shows out off what made the Grateful Dead so special and their musicality. So that's what I would suggest. That would be number one on my list.
Okay, so we're going to go out. We're going to listen to the Great American Music Hall in 1975. It's the Grateful Dead. Scott, I appreciate you taking some time in the midst of your convivial festivities to chat with me today. And forgive me if I didn't know anything, I apologize, but I'm grateful to now know more than I did 30 minutes ago.
My pleasure. We all start somewhere, and I'm a big fan of podcasts. Glad to be here.
We're back. The Jam is alive. Round two. Mark Tracy is here. Mark, what's shaking?
Shakedown Street, apparently, right?
Yeah, as I learned in the course of creating this episode. Mark is a culture reporter at the New York Times in my department. Mark, based on the article that you wrote a few weeks ago, saying goodbye to the dead again, it seems like this is your bailiwick.
A bit. a bit.
Okay, so can you situate me, first of all, before we get into the weeds, can you situate me, how does a young man of sterling repute fall into this scene?
I'll be totally honest, and maybe this is heretical, I came to them through Phish, which is probably not the most typical of trajectories. I think it depends on your generation, actually.
Okay, so Scott Bernstein, who was our first guest, he both edits Jambase, but also on a Phish blog, writes crazy on a Phish blog. So he's dipping toes in both waters. So he's not, no discrimination here.
And this is a whole thing, like Phish and Dead, not in terms of a rivalry so much as like how much are they the same thing, how much are they not. You know, in the popular understanding, they're the same thing. Musically, if you go to a show, you will very clearly see that they're not really. There's a great Trey Anastasio of Phish is asked in the documentary Bittersweet Motel, which is, I believe, the first feature film by Todd Phillips, who's now Todd Phillips of The Joker and Old School. But he's asked about the whole Dead thing, inevitably. And he says, look, I love the Dead. They're a great band, but they grew up in the 50s listening to Bluegrass and Muddy Waters. I grew up in the 70s, like going to the mall. It's completely different. But so I came through Phish, really through my camp. I'm from the Washington area, but went to camp with a bunch of Long Island kids, which is starting to get really Phish territory. Got into Phish. I think it was also just searching for something in my life, or in the culture rather, like Phish, something that's very rewards kind of obsessiveness, is kind of cerebral, is a subculture, but was never going to be punk or heavy metal for me. That's just not, no shots, just not what I am. So I got into Phish, and then you do, you know, by osmosis, by reading the blogs, in fact, by reading Phish.net 2001, right? You learn about the Dead, and I always knew who they, you know, I'd known about the Dead, but I really started learning more about the Dead. My cousin Debbie got me into the Dead. She's like of the older generation, but the youngest of them. So like of that generation, of like my mom's generation. So like she had that kind of musical taste. I think she probably bought me my first Dead albums, which were probably Dead Go to Nassau, 1980, and the Essential Europe 72.
When you were reversing into the Dead and realizing the differences from the musical differences from Phish to the Dead, did it take time for you to accept that a similar kind of community or whatever could be built around that? Did the fact that the music was radically different affect anything about your relationship to the community aspects of both scenes?
Yeah, I mean, it was never going to be mine in the way Phish was. I mean, of course, arguably, Phish could not be mine either. I came too late to that, having come to it in 2001, right? But no, I felt a bit of ownership with Phish. I really went in hard on them, knew the stuff. The Dead were so ancient compared to Phish that they were never going to be mine, that scene. But that was okay. And musically, it was a lot, frankly, more simpatico with the classic rock stuff that I tend to love. What they really reminded me of was like they were clearly one of Phish's influences, along with prog rock and Frank Zappa and whatever else, right? And then from there, I tended to learn more about the water that the late 60s, early 70s Dead was coming out of, like music from Big Pink and stuff like that. But I mean, I think the one other thing that I kind of understood is that like there was a similarity in that famously no two shows are alike and they're going to jam things out. You know, I'd be interested to know whether jam is anachronistic when describing like the Dead. I don't actually know. I don't know when that word came about. The phrase jam band, right? Like you wouldn't really call the Dead a jam band. They kind of preceded the jam bands almost, whereas Phish is a jam band, right? But I understood that they improvised the different versions, different set lists, and that was similar to Phish, and that would lend itself to like a community that wanted to travel with the band, wanted to obsess over the band, trade tapes, et cetera, et cetera.
One thing that you talked there, well, there's two things in your piece that jumped out at me. One is that there's tension sometimes internally, even within the Dead and extended Dead ecosystem. People are mad John Mayer showed up or whatever, that there's like generational intergenerational tensions, or yeah, probably both, I guess. The other thing, and you get into this by talking about younger folks who have really taken to this scene and even the connections of this scene to dance music, rave culture, etc. Like I remember when I was covering concerts more regularly and occasionally festivals, which I will not do anymore because I guess I'm finally a grown up now. It took a while, but I think I'm finally a grown up. But I remember stumbling upon, I'm not going to remember the name. Someone who's listening, I'm sure will know what I'm talking about. But it was a festival in upstate New York somewhere, like actual, like real upstate, And it was essentially all the optics of the bands, like all the visuals felt like rave or EDM, but all the music was like electronic jam. And it was like 50 artists. I'd never heard of any of them, but I was looking at like videos from the prior festival and it's just tens of thousands. It's camp, you know, it's a camping festival. And I was like, this entire universe, like I pride myself on paying attention to all the different micro scenes. And I was like, this entire thing slipped right past me because it limbed two spaces that I sort of are blind spotty to, like improvised music live and like, at least in the 2010s, rave culture, like 90s, different story. 2010s, I was not as dialed in. But I was struck by people talking about those consonances, right? So can you talk, maybe let's tick the first thing first, about here's a group, the Grateful Dead, that has been multiple iterations. You know, we are now in the final tour of Dead & Co. OG fans, what are they still showing up for and what are they excited about?
One thing, and this is also true of Fish and true of, say, a certain artist known for touring this summer, is there are Dead eras, just as there are Fish eras. There is the late 60s Dead when they were just playing kind of psychedelic blues. They're playing the same set list every time, and that's on the album Live Dead. There's early 70s Dead. There's late 70s Dead. There's different years, different tours. It's almost like wine or a vintage. I don't think it was always necessarily completely unnatural or completely unexpected that like the Dead would keep going post-Jerry because of that whole dynamic that there it was already accepted that like the band was constantly changing, was dynamic, to say nothing of the fact that, like, the Dead lineup had changed. So I think when they keep coming back to the Dead post-Jerry, or they go to see Rat Dog, Bob Weir's band, or Phil and Friends, Phil Lesh's band, I think a lot of them are excited to hear the same songs, the same songbook, in a different way, played by different musicians. I think they're excited to be in the same place as a bunch of other people committed to this same esoteric, Byzantine, complicated culture, and again, songbook. I've often wondered what it is about Dead music, what it is about Fish music, frankly, that lends itself quite to the obsessiveness beyond the improvisation. I do almost think there's something to it a little bit, although different things, because again, they're very different bands. In the case of the Dead, John Mayer was great in his interview. I gotta say, I know he's a polarizing figure. He was wonderful, and he was really talking about the Dead songbook and actually talking a lot about the lyrics. And Dead lyrics are just tremendous. A lot of them by Robert Hunter.
I know this is a too big of an umbrella question, but what are they about?
As he said, they're about people trying to get people who are not home. He said, Grateful Dead songs are not at home. And he's right. And he also said something funny, but true, which is he always imagines them taking place like within a 60-mile radius of each other, all the songs, which is both literally true and that they often, they're a California band, of course, but like a Bay Area band, but the songs take place in the inland west, like the Southwest, leaving Texas, 4th day of July. I set out from Utah, I was trailed by 20 hounds, half a mile from Tucson by the morning. That's another lyric from the same song, but there's a lot of that. But also spiritually, it's a less inhabited place.
You're saying because of that, it isn't exclusionary in a way?
It's itinerant. It's itinerant. The songs are about going places, and the shows are about going places. And of course, some of this is literal, right? A part of Dead shows for lots of people was tripping, right? Taking acid. And that's about going places.
Drugs?
At a Dead show. Amazing.
Oh my God.
Incredible. Which is all to say that I think, yes, there are the people who are never going to go see the Dead post-Jerry, right? And there are definitely people who go see the Dead post-Jerry, but will say, and this is actually in my article, one person doing this, but lots of people did it, I saw 72 shows with Jerry. It's not that I'm averse to seeing shows post-Jerry, but let's be clear, I saw 72 shows with Jerry. Because the music and the band is always about going places, I do think it lends itself to evolving and to mutating. What's Phil and Friends, and I went to a Phil and Friends show as well for this article. The scene didn't really make it into the article, but I went, and I, for me, who never saw the pre-Jerry Dead, I was 10 when Jerry died, Phil and Friends are actually my thing in terms of the Dead world. I used to go see them in college at the Beacon Theater when Warren Haynes was the guitarist. And now their guitarist is the guitarist in Goose, which is the kind of successor of Fish, right?
Yeah, we talked about Goose in the last segment as well. Yeah,
I bet you did. I bet you did. And that feels totally natural and organic to what the Dead are, which is similarly like adding John Mayer doesn't seem as crazy as it might have initially sounded, at least to me. It doesn't, it's not crazy that there's Dead & Co. It's not crazy that I saw Joan Osborne's first show with the Dead. They played Casey Jones at the end of the first set, I remember. And she was great. And they had, through the 70s, they had a woman singer as part of the band, Donna Jean Godshaw. So it was not totally random for an iteration of the Dead to have a female voice on stage. And it just they always lent themselves to that. And it's interesting, by the way, if we're going to do the compare and contrast, other than their original guitarist who left a couple years in and was replaced by Paige McConnell, Fish is the same four guys. And it might be, I don't want to think about it, and unfortunately really haven't had to think about it. I don't know how a Fish without those four guys would fly. That would be different.
Like, I think part of the reason there can be so many spin-offs, whether individual members or just like reconstituted versions, is, to me at least, from the outside looking in, so much of the Dead is mythos as much as it is music. And I wonder, is Fish as much mythos as music?
It's a great question. I would say yes. Fish is always about, yeah, the answer is yes. Because if anything, maybe even more, or not maybe more, but like more by design. Like, Fish is about entertaining you. Like, they're going to give you a good show, and they're going to do it with music, of course, first and foremost, but like, they're going to do it with vacuum cleaner solos. They're going to do it with the lights. I actually wrote an article about the Fish lighting designer. They are going to do it. There was a tour where they were playing chess with the audience, one move by move. They would do two moves a show or something. The Dead aren't that. The Dead are there for the music, right? And like, the music, because of the sheer volume and the grandiosity of the music and of the lyrics, created a mythos. And of course, the taping culture, right? Which is the Dead's, you know, maybe most indispensable thing that Fish et al. Inherited, right? Is like the culture of taping, trading shows. Now it's, of course, just knowing different shows and like going and knowing what this Dark Star was like compared to that Dark Star, what that year's Dark Stars were like compared to that year's Dark Stars. So yes, I would say there is a Fish mythos in a similar way. Again, it's a little different because Fish is operating in the Dead's shadow, and they're postmodern, where the Dead are high modern. But yeah, I would say there is a similar mythos.
When you were talking to fans and talking especially to younger folks, I'm curious.
Younger folks love the Dead. It's amazing.
Yeah, I want to know about
younger
that.
Younger than
like, I will say, socially, anecdotally, certainly through my time hanging out with kids who like getting dressed and love the aesthetics of the Dead and Deadheads. Shout out Mr. Mort and his legendary Dead style book. And to say nothing of all the kids, random folks I follow on Instagram, posting from the lot of different...
Such a moment.
Yeah,
such a moment they're having.
Like, it's really... And also, as someone that thinks a lot about clothing, like, I remember a few years ago having to recalibrate and say, like, no, this is positive aesthetic. This is not anti-aesthetic.
Isn't it? I mean, you know more than I, but I think it is.
Yeah, no, it definitely is. It's just as someone who was raised on Tommy Hill and Polo. It takes a little bit of brain rewiring. What were the... Mark, what were the young folks saying? What were the young folks telling you?
The young folks were like, often they had a parent or two who were Dead people. It was passed down to them.
They got it in the home.
They didn't always get it in the home. Sometimes they got it in the home, but sometimes they were like, my parents were into the Dead, and that meant I had no interest in the Dead. And then I went away to college or whatever. And then I was like, oh my God, now I get it. It's truly fascinating, and it really does feel, I mean, this is totally anecdotal, but like, among Gen Z, I feel like the Dead are bigger than Fish, even though Fish is still like Fish, right? Like, it is, as I said, it's the same guys who were doing this in the 80s and the 90s, and they're younger. And I don't entirely, I certainly can't speak with expertise to Gen Z, which is not my generation. I don't exactly know what that is, but... Not to say Fish is inauthentic, because, I mean, this is the whole point of what Trey was saying about going to the mall in the 70s. That's authentic too, right? But that's a kind of more proximate experience, even to a Gen Z person, than I don't know, whatever the Dead were doing and listening to in the 50s and 60s. There's a part of Long Strange Trip, which is the Dead book, the Dead biography. I interviewed, the author's name is escaping me at the moment, but I interviewed him for this story. I read that book probably when it came out in the like mid-aughts. There's a great scene where Phil Lesh is driving an ice cream truck and Subterranean Homesick Blues, the Dylan song, comes on. And it's like the first like rock song of its kind that he's heard, and it changes his life. And that feels more... less proximate than being college kids at the University of Vermont in the 80s who like listened to Boston, which again is great. And it's as authentic to who they are as what the Dead are, but it feels a little closer. And therefore it's not as much of a trip to go to it, to go to where Fish is. Whereas to listen to the Dead in 2023 is, it's like another country.
At best, my understanding of it is anecdotal. I do think being a part of a Dead community or Dead adjacent community feels like all of the underwiring of the internet and connectedness with none of the technology.
Yes. I mean, but that I think it's this. I mean, because that is very true. What you just said is 1,000,000% true and important. It's just also true of Phish. And in fact, like Phish was super early to the internet. Phish.net was like a very early website. Unsurprisingly, what I think it is maybe is this, is just as much as Phish, maybe even more, like the Dead reward obsessiveness, they reward investment, you're going to get a return on that investment. But like the initial hurdle, the initial price of entry is a little lower because the Dead's most like accessible stuff is pretty accessible. I mean, American Beauty is like a very prominent and important and easy to listen to classic rock album, as are lots of their stuff. Fish's stuff is always going to be a little more weird and esoteric. Like their classic songs are like not accessible in the same way. They're like 7-minute composed suites because Trey was like studying fugues at Goddard College and stuff like that. Whereas the Dead were like playing folk rock at that point. And like the Fish got to that era too. And there are Fish albums that are like that, like Billy Breathes, but that's not as quote classic Fish in the way like the American Beauty songs are classic Dead. So I wonder if that's also part of it. Is it's just they're probably a slightly easier to get into. And I don't mean that in a bad way to the people who get into
way. But I think you're right about entry points and also the Dead's relationship to the sort of dominant music of their era versus Fish's relationship to the dominant music of its era. Yeah, the Dead is not as much of a leap away from the dominant music, whereas Fish definitely felt like it was in a different ecosystem.
Definitely.
Like entirely. Okay, here's the last question. This is a personal question.
Oh.
Look, you're a grown-up. I know you're a parent.
I am.
Is your relationship to the instability of improvised music changed at all in your middle age and in parent or in your parent era?
Great question. And I should caveat and first point out that for Father's Day, I did get a Grateful Dead t-shirt and my older son has a similar Dead t-shirt and I deliberately wear them together.
Getting it in the home.
No, I think if anything, I latch onto it more. My home life is very routine. You're right about that. Little kids both require and frankly thrive on routine. I know mine do. And that's great. That's wonderful. That's where I am in my life right now. But it's nice. They go to bed. I'm in bed at night going to bed. Go to archive.org and turn on some random Dead show and hear the songs in different ways. I recently got into, there's this one show from like 1982 in New Jersey that Jerry Garcia, it was the Jerry Garcia Band, which there you go. The Jerry Garcia Band was a spinoff of the Grateful Dead that existed for most of the Grateful Dead's lifetime with Jerry. But it was a solo show. It's a solo show and it's on archive. It's on YouTube, frankly. And it's really the only instance of like Jerry Garcia playing songs, just him on acoustic guitar. It's totally different. It's totally wild. It's the last thing you think of when you think of Jerry Garcia is him like accompanying himself with guitar chords, right? Like he's this plucker. He's this bluegrass inflected lead guitarist plucker. And so it's totally different and it's great. And I love it, even though it's different and maybe precisely because it's different. So no, it's like, there's that line. It's you need discipline in your life so you can have creative chaos. Like Philip Roth, like famously would retreat to his cabin in the Connecticut woods and write a ton of books about wild, all sorts of depraved wildest, things.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, it's a wonderful question. And no, I find it's even more. The difference now is, though, is going to shows is much more. Literally going to shows is much more of a lift for me because I'm usually going to be up at 6 a.m. the next morning anyway. So that, it has taken a hit. But that's okay.
I said to Scott, I was like, look, I'm a novice. I don't know anything about any of this. If you're going to point me, and maybe you should do this for Fish. He did this for the Dead. If you're going to point me.
I had my Dead answer already, but that's interesting.
Oh, no, give me both. Give me both. To a show, to like a signature show that I should just take 3 hours and just throw on and will teach me something and afford me entry.
Not in the same way that there is for the Dead, there is a standard answer to the Fish question. And the answer is 12/31/95, New Year's 95. It's the closest thing they have to a Cornell show, although, again, it's not the Cornell show. And it will teach you what they were doing at their first peak. The third set jam, the Weekapaw Groove jam, will teach you what a Fish jam is. And for the Dead, I would say, actually, it's not a show. It's Europe 72. It has a couple jams, but what it really is it's like, you know, American Beauty and Working Man's Dead are like these two like early 70s folk rock albums. And some of their songs are on Europe 72, but also there's almost this lost third album. Never recorded for studio of like Brown Eyed Women, which John Mayer sings beautifully, Jack Straw, China Cat Sunflower, Tennessee Jed, all these songs that are that same era, but there is no studio version of them. This is the closest thing. And because they're live, they're a little looser, and that would be my Dead answer. But yeah, I'd go with 12/31/95 Fish.
So I have a bunch of homework. Maybe on a subsequent podcast, I will render, I'll render my verdicts. Thank you to Mark Tracy. Thank you to Scott Bernstein. Listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. All the podcast deluxe episodes, which are on YouTube, where you can watch me and Joe look at each other and razz each other about what we're wearing. That's at tinyurl.com/podcast deluxe. Facebook group, Discord, tinyurl.com/podcast Facebook, podcast Discord. We're about to do a mailbag episode. Email us at podcast@nytimes.com. If you have some Fish or Dead adjacent memories you'd like to share, or if you want to get involved in the improvisational music discourse on podcasts, email us or put it in the mailbag channel on the Discord. Subscribe to podcasts anywhere you get your audio content. That's Apple, Spotify. We're working on the Google Podcasts thing. Apparently there's some issue. I've seen everybody complain in the Facebook group. We're working on it. Our producer, as always, is Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media. Mark, what song do you want to hear as we go out today?
I would love to hear Eyes of the World.